Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And it's always a special program when Jim Petras is on, and I'm delighted to have Jim back again. I think listeners to this program know Jim well. His expertise on most any part of the world, certainly Latin America that he's focused on for so many years, but the Middle East and Asia, oh my goodness, he's written about so many different parts of the world and what's going on. And he has a couple of recent articles. My goodness, he's published, hundreds and hundreds of articles through the years. He's published more books than I have fingers and toes three times over, believe it or not. I've read a few of them. And his most recent articles, he's writing about a subject that we certainly address on this program, Obama's foreign policy. He has one discussing Obama's foreign policy failures. My God, we could spend the rest of the day, the rest of the week, and the weekend, and maybe still not cover it all. And another article about Obama's animal farm. Oh, indeed. I the way Obama is pursuing foreign policy, Jim, I guess it's like Orwell's War is Peace idea. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve, and good morning to you and your audience.
Oh, again, it's terrific having you back. So much to talk about, and I think we would probably agree that we have a new president in the White House a few months in office, and I don't see a lot of difference between Barack Obama and George Bush. If anything, I think things are going on that are even worse, certainly what's going on in Afghanistan or what apparently is planned.
Hello?
Jim?
Yeah.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, I'm saying that I don't see very much difference between Bush and Obama. And in some respects, I think what Obama is pursuing is worse. And Exhibit A, on foreign policy, that is, Exhibit A is probably Afghanistan. Pakistan, too.
Yes, I think you're right, Steve. Obama has escalated the troops in Afghanistan over and above what President Bush assigned to the area. He's pressured the Pakistani government. They created 2.6 million refugees in Pakistan without any decisive defeat of the insurgents there. I think the military spending on Afghanistan and Pakistan has increased. There's talk of propping up a failed regime in Somalia, and not clear in which way Obama is going to intervene in Somalia. So just in three cases, there's clear indication that Obama has escalated military intervention in those trouble spots. In addition, he's made it absolutely clear that the U.S. will not be retiring from Iraq. He has indicated that there's a long-term commitment. They are building a huge, what they call embassy compound, but it's really a military base. Looks to me pretty permanent. So the idea was broached during the Bush years of putting a endpoint to U.S. involvement is gone by the boards with Obama.
Oh, I think absolutely. The way to think about Iraq, Jim, is to know our plans there, I think Korea. We came in 1950 and haven't left, but we'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Jim Petras. Talking about Obama, his foreign policy, maybe we can get into some domestic policy too. But in your articles, Jim, in your article on his failures, you pretty much went around the world and certainly those hottest of hot spots, the most worrisome, certainly the wars going on, and heaven help us if we make an absolutely calamitous mistake by attacking Iran, Somalia. I guess if we attack Somalia or Iran, it would be from 30,000 feet. Can't imagine invading.
But, well, I think the biggest danger is the Israeli lobby in the United States that's been putting enormous pressure for a U.S. Attack or a joint attack with Israel on Iran, despite the fact that they have very competitive elections in Iran. Iran is cooperating in the fight against Taliban in Afghanistan and, as a matter of fact, was engaged in supporting the targeting of Taliban forces right after the U.S. Military invasion. So I think it's a threat that comes from the U.S. capitulation to Israeli pressure. And I think the same thing is going on now with Palestine. The Obama calls for a two-state solution, but the great majority of Congress, including the majority of Democrats, are telling him not to put any pressure on Israel on the settlements. Just today, the major Jewish American organizations issued a document, which I just completed reading, claiming that Obama's definition of settlements is wrong, that natural growth, what they mean, the expansion of existing settlements is legitimate. It's not a new settlement. It's playing with words. But in any case, they got 329 congressmen to oppose putting any pressure on Israel, which means giving the Israeli government the green light.
Oh,
so liberals and conservatives, they're all lined up by the a Jewish lobby, the American Zionist organizations, to let Netanyahu do whatever he's doing, which is expropriating, seizing more and more Israeli territory, which marks Obama's entire visit to the Middle East as a failure. There's nothing that Obama can offer Saudi Arabia, Egypt, or any country that he visits that even approximates comprehensive settlement in the Middle East, because his hands are tied regarding the Palestinian-Israel issue and his inability to confront his own party congressional leadership, marks his visit as a mere exercise in rhetoric.
Where is he going besides Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and do you see any chance that he will be rebuffed, at least in as strongly diplomatic terms, so that he will get the message, you are going in the wrong direction?
I don't think they're going to say that. They're going to say you're not able to influence your own government to carry out a two-state policy with the Palestinians. They're going to say Your rhetoric is fine about two states. Your rhetoric is fine about not building new settlements. But you're impotent. You're ineffectual. Your party is going in a different direction. So thank you, but no thanks. You're saying the right things, but you're pushing the wrong buttons.
I think at this point, Jim, also talk of the only talk of a state for the Palestinians is the so-called two-state solution. But my God, there are 500,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank. There is no way in the world that the most drastic change of policy is going to uproot those people and get them to move. At this point, I think they're there and they're going to stay there. My feeling is the only solution is a one-state solution. Let's get rid of this idea of a Jewish state. And let's just have a state for the people who live there, and they're all citizens, and you rip up Israelis' basic laws. Israel has no constitution. They have basic laws. And you just tear that up. You light a match to it, and you burn it, and you start over again, just like Chavez did in Venezuela. Brand new constitution. Put it to a referendum. Well, we know how the referendum would come up. Well, I don't know. I don't think Palestinians have a majority, Jim, even with the West, even with the territories in Israel. I think it's pretty close.
Well, obviously, one state, democratic, secular republic would be an ideal solution. The question is, the majority of Israelis are growing more and more racist. Settlers have a big representation in Netanyahu government. So I think the conditions in Israel are just as negative regarding a one-state solution as they are a two-state solution. Their main policy now is to force the Palestinians out and create a pure Jewish state. And I think that's the big issue, and that's what the entire world, all the international organizations recognize as a mortal threat and a violation of the basic laws of human existence to force people out because they can't work, they can't travel, they can't engage in any kind of meaningful economic activity. And I think Israel is pushing toward the final solution, which is the expulsion and destruction of all Palestinian life in what was originally Palestine.
Oh, absolutely, Jim. I call it slow-motion genocide, and it's been ongoing since before 1948, certainly 1947, when the war began and then really escalated into 48 and then ended.
Yeah, I think the big problem of all that a lot of commentators, even very progressive commentators, refuse to face is that any change in U.S. policy, any effort to pressure Israel by cutting off aid or reducing their free access to the U.S. market and capital markets, investments, all depends on neutralizing the Zionist lobby in the United States. While you have that power, both in Congress and also the representatives that Obama has appointed in his own government, while you have this power structure, absolutely no changes are possible. Obama can say whatever he wants, and Hillary Clinton can insist all she wants, but Netanyahu will still stick his thumbs in their eyes and tell them, you can't do anything against us because we have too much power in the United States. And I think until there is sufficient counterforce in the United States to counter the Israeli lobby, I think it's an exercise in futility by Obama. And the point is, everybody recognizes in the world today that the U.S. government is a captive of the pro-Israel lobby on Middle Eastern issues. Everyone knows that now. It's the elephant in the China closet. The only people that don't write about it is U.S. progressives and liberals. They absolutely refuse to face up to the biggest obstacle to a Middle East settlement is not Israel. It's the Zionist lobby in the United States which backs Israel. Israel without the lobby, it would be subject to enormous pressures, economic pressures, military pressures. It would be totally isolated in the world. The European Union would develop a backbone to impose trade restrictions on Israel. It would be possible to bring Israel to reason. But as long as they can count on this enormous power structure in the U.S., they will act with impunity, with all the arrogance that is evidenced today. Obama says two-state. Netanyahu says shove it. And shove it, and I will still get my $3 billion a year in aid. So what's the point? Where can Obama find an opening to bring about any reasonable changes?
Well, absolutely. Right. Absolutely, I agree, Jim. And you literally wrote the book on this a couple of years ago, your book, The Power of Israel in the U.S., and you explained the power of this lobby. It's not just an AIPAC. It's not just one or two other organizations. This thing is pervasive. It is just embedded into this country. And you go across the board, the government, industry, the clergy, the media,
and even in your family. Listen, Steve, it gets down to a very personal level. If you even try to reason in your hospital or in your school or in your extended family visits, you'll get a big argument. They'll fight you every inch of the way. I don't know about your own personal circumstances, but I've run across people that will engage me in any setting. They have a very committed and dedicated mass base of maybe a few hundred thousand or close to a million people. Now that's less than a half of 1%. But they are outspoken, they're aggressive, and they'll take you on even at the holidays, on your holiday dinners.
Well, I'm not the most popular person in my own family, Jim. I do know that, and I think most of the feelings come at me in silence. People think I'm some kind of a kook. I imagine that how can you call yourself a Jew and talk the way you talk and write the things you write? Some people in my family get my articles.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jim Petras. Jim, attacking Israel is really the third rail in this country. And a couple of times I quoted Edward Said, who made a comment that you might get most of the House. There are always some outliers in the House who can get away with it. But he talked about the Senate. He said, in a matter of hours, the entire Senate, 100%, could be mobilized to support Israel on virtually anything. Now, that's a very sad testimony to politics in this country, and it says a heck of a lot about the power of the lobby.
Yes, Steve, and of course, a lot of other issues are on the agenda here, and I think we ought to move on. And,
oh, indeed, indeed.
Take some of these things into account. And I think one of the big issues is the committee that Obama put together on the General Motors and the Chrysler. And I looked at the conditions that were imposed by the Obama administration, which were absolutely devastating for the auto workers. I mean, there's going to be about 30,000 workers losing their jobs. There's going to be over a million retirees who are going to lose substantial parts of their health benefits. These are the recommendations, not recommendations. These were the conditions imposed by Steve Rattner and the rest of the Obama-appointed team. I mean, they were much worse than the banks. They were much worse than the auto companies themselves. The solution was draconian in a sense that they gave the companies a green light to savage contracts that were secured by the workers over 40 years. Never has a union been so bashed as they have been bashed by Obama's committee on the restructuring the auto industry.
But, of course, the union surrendered, and I think that's absolutely outrageous. These guys get big salaries, and they literally stabbed the rank and file in the back. I mean, they
capitulated, but the authors, the intellectual and administrative implementers of the plan that the unions committed to, the union officials, was a plan put together by Obama, by Summers, by Rattner, and the whole lot of them. I think we have to put the political responsibility. I agree with you on criticizing union leadership for supporting this or going along with this. But let's face it, it's Obama who savaged the union, set a precedent for some of the most onerous conditions for government financing.
What really bothers me, Jim, I think at least two things bother me very much. General Motors, going back when we were a lot younger, was as iconic a U.S. Corporation as any. The old idea, Charlie Wilson, what's good for General Motors is good for the country, and maybe the other way of saying it, as General Motors goes, so goes the country. It seems to me that the demise of General Motors may be an epitaph for America down the line. And the second point is that I think there's a plan to literally destroy the last remnants of organized labor in this country. Oh, let them stay organized, let them have unions, but literally strip them of any power, so workers have virtually no rights. We talked about the Bilderbergers yesterday. Jim had on Daniel Estulin. They just had a meeting in mid May. And apparently, they have a lot of big ideas. And one of them in the book that Estulin wrote was they want a two-class society world. Rulers, a very tiny sliver at the top, and serfs. So they want working people just to have jobs, low pay, no benefits, that kind of thing. And they want it all militarized so that anybody who gets out of line, we just get rid of them. And I think General Motors, I think the auto industry, whatever GM does, well, Chrysler, same thing. Ford will pretty much follow. And there goes that powerful United Auto Workers Union. And then I think they take aim at the others. They'll go from one to another. I don't know that they'll do it right away. But I think the idea is to strip organized labor of any power. And just all these benefits that they had way back when. Their goal is to literally take them all away.
Yes, that's true, and I think there's no political alternative because the union leaders still tag after the Democratic Party. I think the issue has to be resolved at the political level. I think one can't continue to simply think that the issues can be resolved by this or that trade union. I think the Obama regime demonstrates conclusively that the Democrats and the Republicans are dead set against workers and workers' rights and unionization and decent living standards. I think the big breakthrough in America isn't simply being militant on the shop floor of protesting in the streets of Detroit. It has to go into the political sphere. It has to go into getting voices in a new party that can back public action. And we don't have that party at this time. And as long as people think of the Democrats as the alternative, we'll continue
We need to take another break. Let's do that, and we'll come right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jim Petras, talking about an array of Obama administration policies. Jim, all through the campaign, I was much more concerned about an Obama presidency than a McCain presidency, and some people disagreed with me. What scared me was that this guy looked different, he talked differently, he acted differently, and it just struck me that we didn't know what he would do until he got in. We could guess a lot of what he would do. But here's a guy who could get away with things that I don't think a John McCain could have been able to do, or certainly not easily. Just like Nixon went to China, I don't think Hubert Humphrey or George McGovern could have done that, certainly not easily. So Obama is able to couch what he's doing in the language, the terms, whatever, he's doing it. And he still has majority support in the country. If McCain were doing the exact same thing, I think he'd have an approval rating about as low as George Bush's was toward the end, or pretty close to it.
Well, I think this is very clear. And if you compare the peace demonstrations under Bush and Obama, under Bush, you got hundreds of thousands of people protesting against the war. Here is Obama escalating the war in Afghanistan and threatening new wars in the Middle East, and 10,000 people show up. So what's the difference? The difference is that many of the peace leaders were shills for the Democratic Party, and they used their protest against Bush not in opposition to the war, but basically opposition to the Republicans. And many of these people are angling for low-level or middle-level jobs in the Obama administration, or are simply holding back and telling people to wait and see, or even explaining away the war, saying, "Well, Afghanistan is different from Iraq. Pakistan is a crucial player, etc." And I think the greatest damage of the Obama administration is the way in which it's co-opted and neutralized the black movement, the peace movement, the trade union bureaucracy, etc. They're all part of the tail that the head is wagging. And I think this is the crucial issue, I think, once again, is unless the peace movement develops a independent leadership, or unless the black community develops independent leadership, independent of the current hacks that the tail end of the Democratic Party, that are party bosses, that the first loyalties is to the Democrats. We're not going to get any response to the terrible crisis. And all this talk about an economic recovery, the stock market's going up, it's not based on any objective realities. The only thing they're saying is progress is that the rate of decline is slowing down.
Exactly.
That doesn't mean anything. It means only that instead of losing 650,000 jobs, we're losing 580,000 jobs a month. So the problem is still deepening, and it's bound to slow down after you've laid off 15% and 20% of the labor force. Well, there isn't that much more to fire and lay off. And so obviously it's going to decrease as the numbers increase.
Oh, very true. I read an article the last day or so written by Dean Baker, economist, and he made the exact same points as you are, Jim, that, things were just plunging. They don't keep plunging forever. They do slow down a little bit, but they're still going down. And then they report a number, the most recent number of whatever, and they show something that looks a good bit better than the previous month. But what they don't tell you is that the previous month's data was revised down from the original report. And they do this deliberately, Jim. And then all the numbers are really jerry-rigged to make them either look a little worse if that's what they want, or a little better if that's what they want. And
well,
they very quietly the next month or the month after, they revise them when nobody pays any attention.
Well, the other factor that's very big is that the number of people that are being downsized in terms of their salaries and health benefits. The fact that only 580,000 people lose jobs is part of the picture. 650,000 lose their jobs. But the jobs that people are getting today are extremely low-paid jobs compared to what they had in the past, so that they don't have a living wage, they don't have health benefits, et cetera. So the unemployment figures are just one indicator. What we need to see is the number of people who have a big decline in their living standards, that they go without medicine, they go without medical treatment, their diseases are increasing. How many people are dying today as a consequence of having their medical plans eliminated? How many people are dying because they're not eating nutritional food anymore?
how many people are living in squalid conditions because they lost their homes. I think this is the big picture. I don't think it's necessarily accurate to see the tremendous catastrophe facing the American people just looking at unemployment figures. I think we have to see the enormous change in living standards that we have today.
Oh, very much, Jim. Absolutely. I think, obviously, losing jobs, people losing their homes, I think before this economic situation ends, we will have the greatest housing problem in the history of this country. I think there's a very good chance it will exceed what happened during the Great Depression, with more homes being foreclosed, more people getting into all kinds of problems because of how they got entrapped in a bad mortgage. And they literally were scammed because they got these terrible mortgages, people that never should have gotten them. And they were solicited, literally, many of them, door-to-door by people going into poor neighborhoods trying to trap poor people into buying a home with a low teaser rate for a short period. And then the rates being jacked right up, knowing that these people can't make these payments. So they're going to get them into trouble and take their homes away. And then this terrible economic holocaust that I like to think of it, and the idea that we're coming out of this, and the terrible toll, all these other things that you're mentioning, Jim, that have been going on for so many years. I've had a couple of programs on it. Economist Rick Wolf came on a couple of times and talked about how, go back to the 1970s, and the standard of living has been declining steadily from that time to now. So you've got people working longer in poorer jobs. You've got husbands and wives and families working because they can't get by on one salary. So people all these extra hours worked. These good jobs that have just been set off to low wage countries, and it's why I see this country on a path to be turned into Guatemala.
It's also affected the family life, the quality of life. There's a high correlation between unemployment and family violence. It goes first with the spouses as the tensions mount, the frustrations over unpaid bills is one of the major causes of family violence and children's violence and abuse. We have data on that from many countries and many years. So the second thing is family abandonment because of unemployment. And the third is alcoholism, suicides, etc. Now, if you add all this together, plus the lack of adequate medical coverage, we're probably getting something like an additional 300,000 people dying a year or suffering major physical disabilities, including murdering of spouses and abuse of children. So I think the cost in not only in the quality of life or in the mortality rate is increasing today. And the idea of a career and education, career, marriage, family, that cycle is being smashed. Who's going to get married when they don't have a decent job? And how are you going to bring up children with a job as a salesman or a saleswoman getting something slightly above the minimum wage? So I think there's all these dimensions of the catastrophe we're facing that get washed out when people say, well, it's only 9% unemployment. We're talking about 30 and 40% of the population, which is seeing a sharp decline in the quality of life and in the life expectancy.
And nobody talks about it in the major media. The only talk is we are recovering. Things are getting better. They're improving. This hype, selling America, Jim, where what you say, millions and millions, growing millions in the country are under such duress economically, emotionally because of what's going on. And there's not a peep about this. It's like we're in the middle of a raging bonfire and nobody notices. Bring me another box of popcorn or something or other. It really is an outrageous situation. Well, I feel a little bit like a voice in the wilderness with this program. but yet it reaches a fair number of people. Jim, I wish we could reach a few million people, because more people need to hear this to marshal their own feelings and have it supported with real information. And you say that we need to make political changes in the country, but at the same time we need some mass grassroots activity to put burrs in the saddles of our political people.
Well, that's very true.
If we don't do it,
Steve,
they're not going to do it.
There's clear examples of how people react to a severe crisis. In my 50-odd years of studying in Latin America, what I've seen south of the border, whether it's in Mexico or in Argentina, from the Rio Grande to Patagonia, is that people organize, the unemployed organize, the workers getting fired occupy factories, the unemployed block the highways and prevent the employers from shipping their goods. You have municipal buildings occupied, and even you have major insurrections that overthrow even elected governments. That took place in Bolivia, it took place in Argentina, it took place in Ecuador, until they finally got governments that were at least paying attention. They elected governments that began to make some steps toward increasing the programs for jobs, for health benefits, etc. So the examples of Venezuela, for example, even with the progressive government of Chavez, the workers pressure him. They had a big strike in the in iron and steel industry. The workers struck. They finally occupied the factories. They called on the government to nationalize them, and the government finally did, because it does have a government, a president like Chavez, who's been demonized, but is doing exactly the opposite of Obama. Instead of bailing out banks, he's intervening in companies and turning them around in behalf of the workers. So there's a lot of examples of what you're talking about: social movements, direct action, that creates a new political context for engaging in politics. You know, we have the highest absentee rates of any industrialized country in the world. In fact, greater absentee than the Caribbean and Central American countries. And that's because people don't see any alternatives, and they sit on their hands. But one could say that's a positive reaction to Tweedly D and Tweedly Dum, but it doesn't get you anywhere. So the minority rules, and they don't pay attention to the abstention rates. So I think it's good to reject the two parties, but you have to take some affirmative action, direct action.
Oh, absolutely, Jim. I certainly agree with that. And it's amazing. There are courageous people, and I think Latin America is a great example where people have done the things that you just talked about. People have gotten soft here in America, in the U.S. We had some of this in the past. We had periods where we had some pretty rough and go labor strikes, and at times they got violent, and people really put their welfare on the line, and they were met by some pretty rough counterforce, police or whatever. But walking out of factories and really going at scabs coming in and so on, some tough stuff in the 1930s and some other periods.
Well, there's direct action now. The doctors, for example, the physicians for a national health plan, weren't invited by Obama and Baucus, Senator Baucus, the Democratic leader, to the hearings. They invited insurance companies. The doctors showed up, nurses. A protest, and Baucus called the cops to arrest them and shackle them, because they didn't want to hear the voices of 60% of the physicians who are now in favor of national health programs. Baucus says we don't need more doctors, we need more cops. That's the leader, the Democratic leader in the committee on dealing with health programs. He invited the insurance companies, the big pharmaceutical companies, who give him $1 million a year in campaign funding, and that's where his loyalties are. But here are the doctors that people said, well, the doctors are part of the problem. 60% of the doctors prefer today a national health plan because they have to fight the insurance for payments. They have to argue in favor of tests because the companies don't want to allow doctors to treat their patients fully. They said it's too expensive, et cetera. So even high-paid middle-class professionals today are calling for a national single-payer health plan. And we have a government that supposedly represents the people but acts for the billion-dollar insurance companies.
Well, we act for the insurance companies, Jim, and we act for the big Wall Street banks that have stolen countless billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. Think what the kind of think what that money could do. Think what a fraction of that money could do to really do some awfully important things to build a country. You could make a checklist, Jim, go right down the line. We're talking about health care, all the other social benefits. But start building the manufacturing base. Spend money on a mass infrastructure program. Put people back to work. Do some of the things that we did in the 1930s. FDR was no saint. But my goodness,
that's true,
Steve. He put millions of people back to work.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And when General Motors gets money from the United States taxpayer and then decides to build a small car and build it in China, what are we getting out of it?
We're getting absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. Jim, we got to take another break, then one last segment, and I'll let you wind it up with your final thoughts on this or anything else we haven't covered. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jim Petras. Oh, Jim, your final thoughts on whatever else we haven't covered or what we have that you want to add more comments about?
Well, I think the main thing that we've been talking about is the incapacity of the Obama regime to carry out any significant changes. We've talked about the devastating effects his economic policies are having in the United States, the incapacity of the capitalist system to provide a comprehensive health program. I think it all points to the need to revive the democratic socialist alternative. I think the idea that somehow we're going to muddle through this is false. We really need systemic changes. We really need a social transformation in this country. We can't keep going through the old channels, the old politicians, and think that somehow we're going to see the end of the tunnel. I think we have to rethink the whole political economic system and work toward a democratic and socialist solution here where public ownership, popular participation in decision-making, direct decision-making takes over.
Jim, I think a very hard look at what's going on and what could be ahead. I think the future is either what you just said or despotism, and I think we're on a road to despotism if we don't figure out a way to get people agitated enough to work hard enough to prevent this. But you can have despotic states come up anywhere. You know the history of Chile. My goodness, Chile was so democratic, and then Augusto Pinochet came along. Well, the same thing could happen here, and the tanks can be in the street. And America can turn into Chile under Augusto Pinochet.
Yeah, one difference. We have the constitutional right to bear arms, and I think that's a final guarantee that ultimately the citizens have it in their power to confront any intervention by the ruling class in this country to block democratic solutions. It's
either through reason or through force, that will bring about change in this country.
Oh, I hope you're right, although we certainly don't want to see shootouts in the streets.
No, not shootouts in the streets, but people defending their democratic right to change the government.
Well, we have to do it. We absolutely have to do it. It just obsesses me. It drives me, Jim, and I want to address it. And, again, the things that you do and the things that I've gotten into the last few years.
You're
and,
doing a great job, Steve, both
well,
on radio
I,
and on
I
the internet.
I do what I can, Jim.
And,
I mean, you've been at this
and
a lifetime on this.
I read your articles faithfully. You've got a faithful reader here.
Well, I read yours faithfully, too, and you give me great material to quote and great thoughts to think about, Jim.
Okay,
and,
Steve, it's been great on your program.
Well, the program is important, too, and I hope we can build our listener base. And we have radio stations around the country that pick us up. I hope more will learn about us and want to pick us up, and they can either do it live or we're
all... Well, I think ultimately the people will be with us because we're standing up for the real America.
Well, we really are. We're standing up for ordinary folks.
Okay. I got to run, Steve.
You got to go, Jim. We're out of time. The music is going to start playing. Let me let you go, and many thanks again, Jim.
Okay,
we will
Steve.
Do this again soon.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you, Jim. And we'll be back tomorrow. Tomorrow and Friday, we have a two-part program. Russ Baker wrote a major, major article on the Bush dynasty. We will have a two-part program. And we will discuss the book that Russ wrote. Oh, I've got it right in front. It is a big, big book. And it's called Family of Secrets. The Bush Dynasty, the powerful forces that put it in the White House, and what their influence means for America. We will talk about it tomorrow and Friday. Join us then.